This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Ever heard of the Blue Helmets? What about the Houston Riots? These pieces of our city's history are ones that seem to get lost or left out of our history books. But with the recent overturning of 110 Black soldiers' sentences and it being Black History Month, we figured it would be the perfect time to talk about the history and the impact of Houston's Black soldiers. That's why we're bringing on the Buffalo Soldier National Museum's CEO Desmond Bertrand Pitts and the Director of Exhibits Cale Carter II to help us uncover some of the stories that help shape Houston today. It's Thursday, February 15th, 2024. I'm Rahil Ramzanali, and here's what Houston's talking about. Desmond, Cale, welcome in the CityCast Houston. We're so excited to have y'all on. How's everybody doing this morning?
Doing great. Thanks for having us.
I'm doing pretty well. Thanks again for having us.
Absolutely. So in our February guide earlier this month, we talked about ways to celebrate Black History Month. So before we jump into this awesome conversation we have planned, I want to ask y'all, Desmond, how do you like celebrating Black History Month?
My thing with Black History Month is, as being a Black person, a Black male, I am Black 365, so I celebrate every day that I wake up. But Black History Month, of course, is very special with, you know, Carter G. Woodson starting the Negro History Week, and then it kind of growing into a full month. I'm here at the museum, so I celebrate it by welcoming guests who want to learn the history that we have to share. But I also do, you know, volunteer work outside of the museum, so I use it as an opportunity for service.
How about you, Cale?
So, well, when it comes to celebrating Black History Month, I do what I pretty much do every year, basically, not only during Black History Month, but pretty much every other month of the year, which is continuing researching the lesser known stories of Black soldiers and Black military history.
Yeah, that's perfect. And you know what? I'm going to ask you this first one because of that research. You know, we always hear about the Buffalo Soldiers and we don't learn about them as much in school, unfortunately. So for our listeners who don't have a good understanding, who are they?
So when you hear people say that someone's a Buffalo Soldier, they're really referring to the first professional Black American soldiers, meaning that these were the first Black soldiers to serve in the regular army and make a career out of serving in the military. Historically speaking, from the American Revolutionary War and even the conflicts before this country was a country, you had Black folks who served. However, it wasn't until after the Civil War where they were allowed to serve in the regular army and make a career out of serving in the military. So normally that's when you hear Buffalo Soldiers, that's what people are referring to. And in particular, they're referring to four Black regiments. Some will say that they're really referring to the one specific one or two. But in most cases, when they're referring to Buffalo Soldiers, they're referring to soldiers that was part of the 9th and 10th Cavalry and the 24th and 25th Infantry Regiment. And kind of the era of the Buffalo Soldiers, where they start at the end of the Civil War in 1866, when Congress authorized the creation of these units, and they last until about 1951, when the last one, the 24th Infantry Regiment, was deactivated during the Korean War. So.
Hey, let's talk about the new exhibit, which focuses on the first African-American combat division to be activated during World War II, the 93rd Infantry Division, but they're also known as the Blue Helmets. What do you want people to know about these men and their service, and what's the big takeaway here for our listeners?
There's quite a few takeaways. One of the main takeaways is, the one, understand the history of this unit, because when you talk about Black military history in World War II, the focus tends to go directly towards Tuskegee Airmen. So one of the main focuses of this exhibition is to, one, get the story of the 93rd out there and get the story of their accomplishments out there. But in addition, one of the other main goals by doing this exhibition is to try to encourage people to do more research into the division itself. So up to this point, this, when creating this exhibition, this was essentially kind of a mixture of years of personal research, as well as collaborations with people within the staff of the museum, particularly Dr. Tovar and Jason Fung, who's our archivist. However, there's still some gaps in that information that we have yet to access. And so the idea behind getting the exhibition created is to, one, try to clear up some misconceptions about the 93rd in terms of what they actually did in the Pacific and like what was their role. But then the core one is to, again, try to encourage people to learn about the unit and what these soldiers did in the war and then after, more important.
How long did it take for their service to be recognized? You still mentioned it's, we're still doing it. We're still getting more knowledge about what happened. But, you know, how long did it initially take?
I'll put it this way. In terms of recognition, I would say really didn't start really getting out there until about 2008 when Dr. Robert F. Jefferson wrote a book called Fighting for Hope, the story of the 93rd Infantry Division of World War II. So that was 2008, but again, like the book that he wrote kind of got the story started, but by and large, their story really didn't get to, shall we say, kind of a popular culture aspect. So their story is still relatively unknown. They're still really not recognized just yet. Like, because when you say recognized, normally people would assume they're recognized, like, oh, it's Tuskegee Airmen, where people, you can walk to someone on the street and they understand. And in the case of the 93rd, like, you really can't walk up to anybody just here and say, oh, do you know who this unit is? They will say, oh, well, I may, but I don't.
Yeah. As CEO of the museum, Desmond, how important is it that these stories are told at the museum? And how hard is it to, you know, decide amongst all these thousands of stories that are so important to be told, like you pick this one? How hard is that?
Knowing that the museum was founded on the simple fact that African Americans in the military just don't get their due justice in terms of their stories being out there. It's continued on in my leadership. And when Kel came on, and he's only been there a year, and this is actually his first exhibition, that's the conversation that we had. And he sent me, after that conversation, he sent me like a full 2 pages of ideas that he had been, you know, researching and already thinking about.
Did you know about the blue helmets before Kale told you, Desmond?
Absolutely not.
Yeah. No, I was so learning too on the job.
Yeah, absolutely learning. And, you know, I learn every day that I'm here.
And listeners will also go through that process of learning, not only about the blue helmets, but just the Buffalo Soldiers in general and like how important they are to our history here. So I love that.
Houston's original neighborhood downtown is for everyone, and it's poppin'. It's our open-hearted home for our biggest celebrations and our treasured hidden gems. From the world-class theater district to incredible green spaces like Discovery Green, downtown is the place to be. In fact, more people visited downtown Houston last year than the entire population of Dallas, Fort Worth, Austin, and San Antonio combined. There's no better time to live downtown than now. From starter apartments to luxury lofts, everyone can take advantage of the arts, business, culture, entertainment, food, and recreation. Now, you might think of downtown as only the heartbeat of Houston's regional economy, which it is, but there's so much more to it, including free events throughout the week with Downtown Houston Plus. From the Market Square Park Farmers Market every Saturday to Yoga Flow every Wednesday, you can find something to do and eat and watch in downtown Houston. Learn more at downtownhouston.org. Downtown Houston, get energized and revived.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Kale, tell me about what happened at Camp Logan, because towards the end of 2023, there was the overturning of the convictions of 110 Black soldiers who were involved in the 1917 Houston riot at Camp Logan. set the stage for me. What happened during this riot?
So prior to the actual date of the riot, there was a series of events that started when the 24th Infantry Regiment was transferred to Houston to help and oversee the construction of Camp Logan. So again, with some historical context, when these soldiers came from their previous post to Houston, Texas, while they had to deal with racism at their previous locations, the racism in Houston was different because you're talking about not just the 24th, but other black regiments who was basically being geared up for service in World War I that were coming from other areas and coming to the Deep South had to basically encounter like stiff Jim Crow law. So when you talk about the 24th arriving in Houston, there was a series of incidences that involved mostly clashes between the soldiers and the local Houston Police Department, and they come to a head on August 23rd, 1917. So a series of events happen, and one of the soldiers in the 24th is badly beaten and thrown in jail. Word gets back to the post that the soldier was killed. And by this point, as I mentioned before, there's been a series of incidences that was occurring kind of back to back, and this led to the soldiers essentially saying, we had enough of this. We're going to basically march into town and we're going to attack anyone who looks like an HPD officer because we're tired of this. We've tried to go through proper channels. However, nothing seems to get done. So we're going to basically take matters into our own hands and address it as best we can. And even though the initial confusion about the guy being killed, the commanding officers and officers trying to say, okay, well, this gentleman's, he's still alive. He's here. By that point, frustrations boiled over and it led to some of the soldiers initially thinking that was coming under attack from armed Houston civilians and armed HPD officers. But then after that, some of the soldiers, after the perception of an initial attack, basically decided to march into town and take the fight to the HPD officers. And it led to cases where the soldiers basically fired on both HPD officers as well as civilians. And ultimately, what ends up happening is that among the people who are killed was a military officer from an Illinois National Guard unit that tried to basically intercede as well. And pretty much after that, the riot itself ended and it led to the trial of 64 members of the 3rd Battalion, 24th Infantry Regiment for basically having a mutiny in a time of war, and which of course a mutiny in a time of war carries the penalty of death.
So 64 soldiers were then executed?
64 members were tried, and initially there was a group of 13 that were executed. So the riot itself takes place in August of 1917, and by December 1917, the first group, which was initially a group of 13, were executed. Now, there was some concerns both in the black press and in other circles about the speed of the trial, because with the trial, there was some concerns about the evidence that was being brought up. There was some things that weren't really clarified. Some of the soldiers who were in that initial group, initial batch of them being executed, some of them fully admitted to participating in the riot. But you had others who basically, in some cases, it really wasn't clarified if they actually participated or not. Some soldiers that were put on trial, they were kind of put on trial in the sense where it's like, okay, well, who did it? If you tell us who did it, we'll let you go. And it led to cases where you had some soldiers who literally had nothing to do with it at all, or people couldn't really verify to say, hey, this guy was directly involved. We couldn't verify if he actually went with the group or stayed in camp. It led to some of those guys getting swept up and tried and even executed as well. So after that initial group of 13 were hung, it led to basically calls for executive review. They said, hey, we have to try to go through and make sure that the people that we're trying are without a doubt innocent or without a doubt guilty. But then there was another group that were executed as well.
So initially 118 soldiers were indicted. So can you tell me what happened to the other 40 soldiers who weren't sentenced to mutiny or executed?
So some soldiers served a variety of sentences. Some had as many as 30 years in prison. Some had lighter sentences. And there was some, like literally there were some soldiers that after they were arrested and they basically served their time, like they pretty much got out in the 1930s. And I think that was one kid, I forgot the gentleman's name, but he actually committed suicide after he was released because pretty much by that point, like when you're serving in the military, like a lot of these guys, when when they were caught up in this, they was in their late teens, early 20s. Like some of these guys, their career was serving in the military. So when you go from basically having a promising career in the military, and not only the promising career in the military, but also the benefits that come with military service, like honorable discharge, pensions, when all that gets taken away, what ends up happening, well, in the case of one of the gentlemen, he literally felt he had nothing to live for, and he committed suicide after. So, like, even though we tend to focus on the people who were executed, the overall story itself is a tragedy, because you're not just talking about the group of soldiers that were executed, but you're talking about a group of soldiers' lives who were drastically altered after that event in 1917.
Hey, Kale, so why did it take so long for their convictions to be overturned, by the way?
Now, honestly, it's going to be probably difficult to answer, because when you talk about military bureaucracy, there's a lot of stuff to it. But the other part of why it took so long was that it took basically years and years of advocacy research to essentially prove the men's innocence, or at least call into question the fact of what was used to convict these men.
Yeah. And let's talk about their families, right? Like, how significant was this decision? And, you know, what does it mean for their descendants of these soldiers? What does it mean for Black soldiers serving the military today, you know, particularly those in Houston, Desmond?
So one of the descendants is, she's like family to me. She actually watched me grow up. Professor Angela Holder, her uncle, was one of these gentlemen. And on November 13th of last year, I sat right behind her, and she was so emotional because she actually led the charge for what happened on November 13th. Like, she had been working 20 plus years to see this day and never thought that she would live to see it happen. And so I think just knowing that she was here to relish in the moment, to experience it, was enough for her. And the overturn, you know, conviction, of course, is what the intent was, but also knowing that the gravestones would be, you know, properly done, and there's some back pay that's also going to, you know, come to the families. None of that even mattered. It's just the fact that she was there in that moment to see that happen, something that she had worked on for years. And one of the other descendants, Jason Holt, who was also there sitting next to her, they were holding hands. And, you know, I was listening to what was going on. But the fact that I knew these two people, and I've watched them work, and I've watched them have conversations and, you know, do interviews like this, talking about their story, it was just a very, very emotional moment. And what is to come of that, I hope, is just a sense of acknowledgement. Like, why do we have to get to a point of the U.S. Army making it a big thing, and it's global now, rather than in reverse?
How is the museum honoring these men now?
So we actually have a year-round exhibition for Camp Logan, and Professor Holder is actually the one who curated that. And what we're actually working on exhibition planning to change our entire exhibit. So we're incorporating Camp Logan in a very specific space and a specific way, and we're working with partners to do a better job in showcasing this story and making sure that the soldiers are get their proper due here.
With the planned exhibition updates, we also want to not only include the Houston riot, but place it in the greater context of what was going on during that period, and also its impacts after. So one of the things that we tend to talk about, especially when we talk about the Houston riot, we talk about the immediate effects in terms of the soldiers themselves and like the legacy of the soldiers and their families. But we don't really talk about cover or how what happened impacts other Black soldiers in World War One. And case in point, like, I'm a South Carolinian. Like, so initially, in case of South Carolina, we don't really hear about the Houston riot. But the connection to it is that pretty much after it happened, anytime a Black unit that was preparing to go overseas came to the Deep South in World War I, especially after the Houston riot, southern towns or cities will pretty much would be immediately paranoid because the fear was that, well, these soldiers did this in Houston. They saw it more so like them reacting to the law and order of the Deep South. So the fear was that, well, if these guys are doing it here, who's to say it can't happen in my hometown or it can't happen in this town? So talking about stuff like that, that connected to the Houston riots, but even talk about the thing that led to it, that was on the soldiers' minds, like the St. Louis massacre or the Atlanta massacre. So like stuff like that, that kind of helped build up to it again, to try to get that whole picture of what the soldiers were dealing with before they got to Houston and also what they dealt with on the personal level after, but then also what was the grander impact of what happened here during that period, and even tying it to the Red Summer in 1919 when the veterans were coming back and literally getting lynched because the concern was that, well, these soldiers, these black soldiers who we expect to stay in place are not going to stay in place no more. So that's one of the things we want to do when we update the exhibition, is to try to add that grander context so people have a better understanding of the impacts of it, both short term and long term.
Yeah, I can't wait to see the updated exhibit and learn even more about the greater context. So are there any other cases that you'd like to see taken with corrective action by the U.S. military? You know, is this just the beginning of past wrongs being righted?
Honestly, I hope so, because there's literally quite a few cases out there. But one of them that comes to mind I would like to see done is when you see a lot of cases of black veterans, not only in World War II, but as late as Vietnam, and dare I say some can say even up to today, where you have soldiers who, and especially in the case of World War II, were entitled to GI Bill benefits, low interest home loans and stuff like that, and they were denied access to it for various reasons. Well, that's something I would like to see addressed. And the reason why is because when we tend to think about the GI Bill, we tend to think about it from the perspective like, okay, well, that's just an immediate benefit for that veteran rather than a generational benefit for those families. Well, what happens when you talk about like black veterans getting locked out of the GI Bill or not being able to use it properly? Well, that impacts the ability to buy a home. Well, in terms of impacting the ability to buy a home, that means that you can't accrue generational wealth. And so when you talk about that and you look at now, we talk about the racial wealth gap. Well, people say, oh, well, why is the racial wealth gap the way it is? Well, there's a systemic policies that have systemically failed not only black veterans, but a lot of families of these veterans over the years.
Desmond, any final thoughts? And also just how important is the museum in helping getting the word out about, you know, some of these stories, and then also advocating for those soldiers and their families?
Yeah, I think, you know, the difficult situation that we've been put in terms of the educational system, we have become the center of sharing those stories. Like, we have to do more. We have to be more present. We have to be more aware, and we have to make sure that we're fact checking and being the most knowledgeable center of these stories and these things that have occurred, because moving forward, I mean, people are going to rely on us, right? And so for me, it's really important that we stay on the forefront and become that place that people go to.
That's awesome to hear. It's right here in the city of Houston, and you know, it's an amazing place, and I hope listeners go check it out. Desmond, Kale, thank y'all so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us as well.
You can get ticket information and hours for the museum in our show notes. That will do it for today. Thank you for listening, and I hope you learned something new.